So I'm going to talk about mushroom bodies, and I'm going to talk about some studies we did in the recent past to relate activity patterns that we measured in mushroom bodies.
You want the pointer, I think it might work.
Okay. Yeah. To relate activity patterns we're measuring in mushroom bodies with perceptual abilities and perceptual and the behavior of the animal and how basically how accurately it forms associative memories. So, but I just wanted to zoom out a little bit and frame this for some of the people. I guess there aren't very many actually right now, but for some of the people not necessarily super familiar with olfaction. For me, the fundamental biological problem that the system has to solve is the fact that there are so many different chemicals out there in the environment, but still you have to be able to usefully, first of all, detect them all to know that they're present, and also be able to distinguish between them, because in some cases you can have really pretty similar chemical compounds like grapefruit and lemon, but they nevertheless smell really very different. So the system has to have both a very high capacity to detect all these different things and a very high discriminability. And those two properties are basically pretty hard to achieve simultaneously. So one of the ways, and of course part of the answer to that is that there are so many different types of sensory input to the system. There's so many different types of olfactory receptors that gives you the capacity to tile olfactory space pretty widely and then presumably use those combinatorially. I'm going to talk about kind of the ascending side of the fly circuit as you go from the sensory layer, which in flies is composed of about 50 different types of receptor neurons, up to an area that I'm going to analogize to cortex, but basically just think of it, I think very generically, as a circuit that expands considerably from sensory layer to deeper areas that do kind of more associative type of functions. So in Drosophila, this is kind of a general feature of all sensory circuits, but in Drosophila, that expansion happens pretty early in the circuit. There are 50 different types of receptor neurons in the fly's antenna, also 50 different types of projection neurons in the glomerular layer of the fly system. But those projection neurons send axons that go up to the mushroom bodies, where they sprout out a couple axon collaterals and send synapses to mushroom body neurons, and then ultimately terminate in this area called the lateral horn. So there's kind of this parallel transmission of information to both mushroom bodies and lateral horn neurons. And I think that's one of the basic features of the olfactory system is that you kind of split off these inputs from the glomerular layer into a learning center and what is actually a pretty well-defined and kind of fairly hardwired system that's involved, we think, in innate behavior in the lateral horn. So that expansion happens between the 50 different types of projection neurons in layer 2 and the 2,000 Kenyon cells in layer 3. I think I already covered that. Like I said, the capacity of the system derives from the fact that you have so many different types of receptors. And in Drosophila, those have been really nicely characterized by John Carlson and his colleagues. And this shows you actually the responses of about half of the different types of receptor neurons in Drosophila to a bunch of different monomolecular compounds. And you can see that for each one of these compounds, there are multiple neurons that respond with pretty high spike rates, and that you get this combinatorial pattern of activity, and that it's the combination of different receptors that are activated that tells you the differences between those different odors, probably. And I like to think of this as just in a really simple and concrete way, is that each of these receptors must be picking out some chemical feature of a chemical compound. Maybe it's hydrophobicity, its chain length, whether it has an ester or not. And then somehow that combination of features is what tells you what the odor is.
This part is wrong and superfluous.
It is?
Yes, because in an array of receptors,
tell us what you really
there is no way of telling that one, and there is also no way of materializing that one receptor will sense hydrophobicity and the other will sense chain length. It suffices to say that the array of activation values is what the brain sees. This is like taking us back to Amour with very simple-minded view of receptors and their relationship to
humans.
and it adds nothing to the discussion.
So again, it's a compliment. Just take it as a compliment.
No. Well, no, I mean, so that was not designed to, I didn't mean these labels as something very specific. I just mean it was chemical features, right? I think that's fair. There are different types of chemical features. Hydrophobicity is not a great...
But I think the chemical feature, maybe Dora, a different view would be that the chemical feature is not definable by anything other than that receptor happened to have that particular invariable tuning curve. It doesn't have to be
exactly right.
Yes, there is a specific tuning that will react to, but there as a class may not actually tell you something that's clusterable.
You can spend an entire life trying to dissect why a particular receptor binds better one ligand than another. There is no good theory for that. It's all empirical. And I mean, you can do all sorts of molecular modeling, molecular dynamics, and so on, but it helps us nothing with respect to understanding the function. It's like asking about quarks. I wouldn't talk about this. It's not, I mean,
in that spirit, I'll press on.
Develop new receptors for new ligands, that's a different story.
Darren, but let me ask you this. So there are class one and class two receptors.
Yes.
Presumably more hydrophobic, hydrophobic. So yeah, by differentiating
inclinations, but
by differentiating responses, if I pull the response of plus one versus plus two, wouldn't I be able to tell hydrophobicity?
By continuing this discussion, I'm shooting myself in the foot. I say it's not necessary to discuss this, and then I find myself discussing this. It's a wonderful slide. It's unbelievable. It's what you do with intensities and erase the errors.
Yes. Yeah. That's totally fine for me. But you've maybe completely forgotten what my next slide was. Another way of representing this, instead of with intensities, is these are the different receptors here, and this is the particular order been presented, and these are the spike rates that are evoked. And just another way of showing that you have these combinatorial patterns of activity. That's all I'm trying to say. And of course, it's useful if these patterns of activity are dense combinatorial patterns, because that gives you high capacity. A very simple point. I have to say, we'll go through the whole talk, and I'll say nothing profound today. That's all right. So dense is useful for this high capacity, and certainly we all agree that you have to detect a lot of different compounds out in the environment to be useful. But if you present a chemically similar odor, in this case hexanal is in red and octan-3-ol is in green, you see a similar pattern of very overlapping activity. That overlap, you know, correlated pattern, lots of overlap, and that overlap is problematic when it comes to learning, which is kind of what I'm interested in.
A really quick tangential question. I noticed that some of those receptors go below zero, which I presume means a reduction in firing rate.
Yeah, this zero is relative to baseline.
Can those act as antagonists against binding of other odorants that would excite that receptor?
In some cases, yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you can push it in both directions with different ligands.
Again, what's the paper?
It's Hallam and Carlson, the classic one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I done earlier slides.
That's a reference to add to that wiki.
Yeah, no, you guys should. That's a really important paper for my field. So I will certainly add that.
There's also a paper that has 500 ligands.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll put both of those on.
They're also recording the spikes, spike frequencies, spike rates.
I'm
not sure.
Yeah.
Because
we're not sure. Look it up.
Spike rates versus.
I'm asking if there is a paper with larger number of
ligands. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I don't know of one with 500 odors. No, this is the most definitive one that I'm aware of that's been published. I don't know if anybody else knows in the room. That would be valuable.
Well, I think John Carson did it for the larva, but I don't think that the data are available. So I mean, you have the specific ligands that. I have it showed yesterday, but I don't think that the data of the 500 orders is available.
But that was in the larva, right? It's a PNH
paper.
But isn't that doing supplements? I mean, you are not on it, right?
You don't have the table with the 500 orders.
Okay. Yeah, I think before you go in, there is Kupski persisting to say, depending on where you're going to go, in some sense, when you say the overlapping orders make it very difficult, that's sort of a function of the noise, right? I mean, if it's very clean, very little variance in any of these, then even if there's one difference, you can still build a classifier to do it.
I can still build a classifier with this. Yeah. That's absolutely true. It just makes it a little bit harder. That's.
I'm not sure, but anyway, that's a discussion again.
Okay.
As long as the noise is very low, it seems like.
All right. Well, like I said, I will not say anything profound today. That overlap, where there are neurons that respond very similarly in some cases to different smells, it's problematic for learning in the sense that if I have a two-layer network like this and I have neurons that respond specifically to citrus, others that respond specifically to cherry, and then an overlapping neuron that responds to both, if I was to just if I wanted to learn that citrus smell was associated with a sour taste and adjust the synapses of all those citrus responding neurons, if I then, that's represented in the increased thickness. If I then present a cherry, I would actually have, kind of an unchanged response here, but this neuron now would all of a sudden signal more strongly to cherry, and that would mean that your perception of cherry would be a little bit different. You can obviously, if there is a perceptible difference between these two things, if you iterate enough, those synapses can change specifically. But it seems like it's, a little bit more for the network to do.
This is not any different from any learning of any paper, like face recognition.
Oh yeah, no, it's a fundamental thing. Yeah, I'm not making any olfactory.
No, brains are very good at looking at very subtle differences, such as face recognition.
Yeah. So what the rest of the talk is how good are flies at looking at those subtle differences, and what are the activity patterns that allow them to see those differences? I'm not saying that they don't solve it. I think they do.
What might be quite interesting is that it is not any possibility, like the capacity of brains to do sudden distinction between patterns, visual, auditory, tactile, and so on, is a reason from very early capacity to do that in the olfactory world, because olfaction is very, very, I know it's taking us completely out of brain, but it's an interesting thought. So studying olfaction is important for understanding pattern recognition as well.
Yeah, I feel like these could be patterns of photoreceptors in the retina. It's the same problem, and it's kind of an interesting question whether olfactory system solves them well, as well or worse or in a different way. This is just to show you that when I was a postdoc in Gilles' lab, one of the things we did was started to record neural activity with single electrodes in antenna lobe neurons and in mushroom body neurons. And presented them with a bunch of different odors and looked at the response patterns in those two different layers. And one thing that we noticed was that the antenna lobe neurons, these projection neurons that are in layer two, respond pretty broadly to a bunch of different odors. Again, it's kind of a broad combinatorial pattern of activity, much like the receptor neurons in kind of a broad way. But mushroom body neurons are really quite different. They're much more selective in their responses. And those responses actually typically right on a baseline of almost zero, and there's just a few spikes, maybe between 2 and 10 spikes that compose a response, and that's it. So it's a pretty quiet brain area that every once in a while, when it sees the right odor, for whatever reason, each cell will respond very selectively to those to particular smell. So this specificity means that maybe this problem of synaptic interference is solved here, right? That's the thinking. And of course, like I said, this is not specific to the olfactory system. I think that what was really exciting for me is that this looked just a little bit like these neurons that have been recorded in perihippocampal areas of the human brain. So this is a neuron in entorhinal cortex that responds, you can see the rasters in blue, responds very selectively to Halle Berry, but not to any of these other images of actually thousands that were presented to this particular human patient. The idea is that these sparse representations and these very selective response properties of these neurons kind of solve that problem of synaptic interference and allow you to form a very specific memory. But of course, this is derived from dropping an electrode into a fly brain, recording from as many cells as I possibly could, but not that many, and seeing that I couldn't, you know, basically didn't see that many responses. So, you know, possibilities were, well, maybe it's just harder to find responding neurons in the mushroom body than it is in layer two. Maybe because there's some kind of autotopic mapping and I can't get to it with my electrode. Maybe I also haven't tried the right ligands, right? I kind of started with a lot of monomolecular compounds. Maybe that's not the right thing for a deep brain area that's involved in, you know, kind of learning related behaviors. Maybe a natural loader would give me something different. So instead of using an electrode to record activity, we switched to using GCAMP to measure activity patterns in mushroom body. And so this is the mushroom body showing its, demonstrating its mushroom shape. These are the cell bodies up here on the top of the mushroom, the cap. The dendrites are here, and the axons travel down here and then branch off. So we expressed GCAMP in these mushroom body neurons very selectively, took a two-photon cross-section through that cell body plane and tracked in that plane typically 5 to 10% of the total population. And this is what it looks like. This is just a movie of a single odor being presented. The movie just loops, so you can kind of look at it. This is the neuropil region where all the dendrites are, and these little grape-like things are all the cell bodies. And so you can see that actually it is a pretty sparse pattern of activity in those cell bodies. This may be 250 cell bodies there, and there's, you know, maybe 12, 15 that are actually responding. So, yes?
When have you ever put a lateral one to the imaging positive neuron to see what kind of spark activity you get?
Have we ever recorded from, kind of correlated the calcium signals with the spikes?
Yes.
Yes. We've tried, but it doesn't work. So I cannot cell attach onto those Kenyan cells and see the spikes extracellularly. Signals just aren't big enough. Every time I try and break in, the GCAMP just diffuses out of the cell. Almost instantly, the cell goes dark. So I can't calibrate the sensor.
But you can do imaging experiment first, and then you break in to get recording from the Kenyan cell.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of course. So I've never actually done that. That feels, I'm pretty confident. I was kind of interested in more quantitative relationship between the delta F and the spiking.
Because you see my motivation of the question, right?
No, you can tell me.
So when you do electrical recording, depends on how big is the sampling sample. And recalling from 50 cells, and you said your imaging experiment identifying, you know, a small population of cells is found. So your probability of hitting an imaging positive neurons with electrode is actually quite small.
Wait, is it my probability of hitting, say the last bit again?
Your probability of, if you only recall from 50 cells with electrode, and that 50 cells happen to be include one of the imaging positive neurons, it's actually quite small.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm sorry, I'm failing to see.
And maybe anyone can rephrase that for me?
But is the issue that are you saying that you're seeing more than chance responses with electrical recordings? Is that the point? If you do electrical recordings, I think he claims that it's maybe not as sparse as maybe you were saying.
Yeah, let me show you a slide at the end where I actually look at the distribution of the probability of response with my electrode and with imaging. And those distributions look very similar to me.
I remember that Javier Peredori, when he was making these recordings, it would take forever for him to fix some signals, right?
Yes, that's
so,
right.
It was recording for primary R, and then it was hard for him to get seen. I think to really do get cases spiking, right? So
yeah. That
tells you a statistic, and just by sampling, the quality of getting a neuron that actually, a case that actually fires is very small. That typically you don't write up in the papers, in the methods, but it's very informative. That's my understanding, right?
I think I know what you want to see, but it's not the next slide.
Is adaptation an issue if you're trying to find one of these neurons that only responds during an odor? Do you have to keep presenting odors while you're looking, I presume?
No. With the electrode, it's a whole cell patch clamp recording. So I just get a good recording. I test a bunch of different odors. There are a lot of cells when I do that that don't do anything. That's definitely true. Yeah. I mean, in that sense, an intracellular recording is biased only spatially, I would say. I don't care about what it responds to when I look for it. I just care that I can patch it. But yeah, to me, it was important to look with imaging and see if, you know, there are pockets of mushroom bodies that just don't have responsive cells and that kind of thing. We then identify, which is a little hard to see, but we then identify each of these cells individually, all the ones that we can track. And the issue is with monitoring all the cells in this field, you see that not every little cell actually has a red marker on it. It's because those move during the course of the recording, so we just have to throw those out. That's just based entirely on how much drift there is in the recording. But we're able to then pick out these individual cells, track their delta Fs over time, and get something that looks like this. So this is about 120 cells that are recorded on a single trial to a puff of odor for 1 second here. And they're arranged by the strength of their response. And everybody below this hard to see red line here are ones that responded with a fluctuation greater than 2 SDs of the variability down here. A fair number of cells respond. This is just a single trial. So we take a 4-second window and compute the delta F values that basically the area under the curve of each of these traces to come up with a response magnitude for all 120 Kenyan cells. So you can think of that, like you guys mentioned, as a 120 dimensional vector. I can say just a little bit about the sparseness thing. So these are the different odors that we presented. This is the proportion of Kenyan cells in the field that responded. And you can see that actually, there's a range. There's a pretty decent range in terms of how sparse it is. On average, about 5% of them respond. But, there are some that are above and some that are below. And it's one thing that I think maybe you guys might find a little surprising, is that that is weakly correlated with how strong or how many Kenyan cells respond is actually weakly correlated with how many total spikes there are in the receptor neurons.
Yes.
So it's not.
Smoothly correlated.
It's weak. It's weak.
Everything is invariant.
Oh, really? I didn't think anybody would care about that.
I'm sorry.
Why did
they
build invariant so early?
What kind of
correlation?
I don't know.
I forget what the correlation value was. But it's not like there's no relationship between what's going on in the antenna and what's going on in the mushroom body. And we also looked at natural odors. We took a chunk of orange, a chunk of mango, yeast and vinegar, put them into our olfactory device, presented them to the fly, looked at the patterns that we got, looked at the fraction of responding Kenyan cells, and it's fair to say that they're on the top end of the spectrum in terms of there are kind of tend to be more responses to those kind of smells, but it's not like they're outliers, way up at 50%. So it doesn't look to me like they're particularly specialized to respond to those natural stimuli. We also looked at the magnitudes of response of those cells and the variability of those responses, the duration of those responses. We chucked all those variables together to see if we could tell what was natural odor and what wasn't. We couldn't. So if you guys have any ideas for what might be special about natural, let me know. But to the extent that we looked, and we looked with these four odors reasonably hard, we couldn't see anything.
And with binary mixtures, have you tried that? So do you maintain the response to, if one order is activating a Kenyan cell, do you still observe the activity if it's mixed with another order?
We only looked very superficially at that. What we saw was consistent with mixture suppression that other people have seen. It's not just a matter of adding one pattern to the next. There's a fairly strong sublinear quality to that. Which is probably why multi-component things like orange and mango don't shoot up. It's that mixture suppression effect. We also looked for any kind of spatial mapping to the extent that we could see it. So we looked, first of all, for whether there are clusters of responding cells, because that would be kind of problematic for us. I have to say, so we looked at the actual distribution of responsive cells. So this is the dark circles, and then the other empty circles didn't respond to any odor in the test set. And this is the neuropil region of the mushroom body. So we asked, you know, are these guys in any way clustered? This was actually, as compared to just shuffling randomly, this number of responses throughout that field of cell bodies. And this was as clustered as it got in our data set, I think, of 18 flies that were recorded. It's, you know, significant compared to random. Doesn't look super clustered to me. Most things, if you look at the p-values of how different it is from random, most of those p-values are pretty high and pretty not significant. We looked at how, when we looked at each of those individual cells, we looked at how correlated their tuning properties were with how far apart they were from one another. And also didn't see any obvious relationship. So it kind of looks like not a particularly structured area in this way. There's quite a bit of discussion about whether connectivity into this brain area is random. This is supporting the fact that it's stochastic, but I think that it's not very strong evidence that it's random, because you saw the picture of the mushroom body, right? There's that big ball of dendrites, and then the somas just kind of sit like a hair, like curly hair on top of that. The soma locations are probably not very stereotyped in that kind of architecture anyway, right? It's not like cortex where there are, you know, pyramidal neurons, and, you know, where the dendrite is relative to the cell body is kind of orderly. Here, the dendrites could be sprayed all around. There's a primary neurite that goes to the cell body, and that cell body is just kind of mixed up in this big hairy mess. So. We looked, we didn't see anything. So, all right. No obvious ototopic mapping, nothing obviously different about something what's behaviorally relevant. Coming back to this question about overlap and, you know, what makes two activity patterns perceptibly different. And, you know, when we started this, it was really not clear to me at all whether flies can tell the difference between those two smells, whether they actually solve this problem. So we asked this question in terms of, you know, can we feed or can we present flies with these smells, and can we tell the difference between these activity patterns? So the diagonal tells you basically how often you got.
One colmograph from hexadiazepine.
Yes, and produce colmograph.
But my rule is just going to be, if you respond, change synapse.